The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here for our first case, 13945, State of Ohio, ex rel. The Cincinnati Inquirer versus the Honorable Michael J. Sage et al. Counsel.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Michael Oster on behalf of the Honorable Judge Sage and the Honorable Mike Moser, prosecutor. At this point, I would ask for 5 minutes of rebuttal time to be reserved. In my opening argument to this court, I would like to stress 3 points. The first is that this outbound call was not a 911 call. The second is that even if this court were to adopt the 12th District's original continuation theory, the call was protected by Criminal Rule 16C and Revised Code Section 1.49.43A1V because 16C is a state law. And finally, that because of all the aforementioned, no statutory damages should have ever been assessed to a prosecutor who acted with good faith to protect a defendant's Sixth Amendment rights. First, the Ohio Revised Code defines a 911 system. In Revised Code Section 5507.01A, the General Assembly gives a definition for a 911 system. That definition is fairly simple. It states, and I'll quote, a system through which individuals can request emergency services using the telephone number 911. In this case, there is a 911 call, a singular 911 call, in which the wife of the victim in this case dialed 911. So we look at the first part of the definition. She's an individual requesting emergency services, and she dialed 911. That is the last time in this case the phone number 911 is dialed. It's the last time in this case that an individual requests emergency services. Based upon those simple facts, the outbound call made to a 513 area code, not 911, that is received by Michael Ray, who is not an individual requesting emergency services, but rather in this case, as we find out, is a murderer, is simply not a 911 call.
Counsel, I know that you've stressed here and in the briefing that this is not a 911 call, but even if we characterize it as something other than a 911 call, it could still be a public record, could it not?
It could be.
So the only reason that we have this focus on whether this is a 911 call is the prior case, the Inquirer versus Hamilton case. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, because the Hamilton County case makes 911 calls per se public records. It makes them not have the ability to be evaluated in these circumstances, not have the ability to be evaluated as far as trial preparation records, not be evaluated as confidential law enforcement records. And so the 911 per se rule that was put forth in Hamilton County is a serious issue in this case. Because first it has to be decided whether this truly qualifies.
Let's say that we agree with you that it's not a 911 call. Why is this call itself not a public record?
The call itself would not be a public record for at least 2 reasons. All of them, the best two stem under Revised Code Section 14943A1V, which is the existing state or federal law exception to the Public Records Act. The criminal rules were modified and rewritten in July of 2010. In July of 2010, what prosecutors were given was Criminal Rule C, which is counsel only. Criminal Rule C, counsel only, allows...
Rule C?
16C. Right. I apologize. The criminal rules were amended. The criminal rules are Criminal Rule 16 is discovery. I apologize. So the discovery rule of Criminal Rule 16C is counsel only. In counsel-only situations, the prosecuting attorney can designate something with a stamp, counsel-only, and that piece of information is to be disclosed to defense counsel only, to no other individual, not even to the defendant, is that to be disclosed. This case, or this court in Beacon Journal v. Waters, has previously determined that Criminal Rule 6E, which is a rule of grand jury secrecy, qualified as a state law. The criminal rules are promulgated as rules of procedure. If a rule of procedure 6E, Criminal Rule 6E, is a state law, Criminal Rule 16C should as well be garnered with a designation of a state law. It also comes into play that in the Criminal Rule 16A, why are these rules given to prosecutors and to defense attorneys for discovery? The statement very clearly was they were to protect the integrity of the justice system, to protect a defendant's right to a fair trial, and to protect victims, witnesses, and society at large.
What was the motion that was filed in this case? Was it a 16C motion?
We filed a motion for a protective order under Criminal Rule 16C, which was designated to the Cincinnati Inquirer and to defense counsel that we intended to label this call as counsel only under Criminal Rule 16C.
Was it really a motion for a protective order? Do we have to, why was it both a Rule 16C motion and a motion for a protective order?
Well, I think it was both, and that dovetails into the second reason why Revised Code Section 149.43A1V state law applies. Because we're also allowed to take different pieces of information that would prejudice a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to trial before a trial judge, and the trial judge applies a two-part test to determine whether the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial would be violated. And so the protective order in this case was filed not only because of 16C, but also because of the prejudicial nature of this call.
Counsel, what was the defense? What was the defense of the defendant here at trial?
At trial? Michael Ray tried to assert a number of different things. I believe he tried to assert some form of self-defense, but because of this call, that clearly couldn't work. When the call itself makes the ultimate legal conclusion, I'm a murderer and you need to arrest me. I snapped. I stabbed him with a hunting knife. The self-defense argument really didn't work, and this call in essence eliminated almost any defense that Michael Ray would have had to these charges. And so the protective order, Justice French, was really written for two purposes. And both of those purposes, Criminal Rule 16C and the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial, which I will say under Shepard v. Maxwell, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that that Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial is the paramount right. It trumps the First Amendment.
But the disclosure of the record or the disclosure of the call doesn't change what the defendant can use the call for, correct? I mean, why was the disclosure, in what way does that inhibit his Sixth Amendment rights?
Well, the Sixth Amendment right, based upon this, if this call were played on the 6 o'clock news, it would be next to impossible to seat a fair jury in Butler County.
So it was all about voir dire?
Not solely about voir dire, but potentially, yes, because when you're trying to protect a Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial, your pretrial publicity definitely comes into play.
Were his rights violated at the time that that it was disclosed? I mean, eventually it was disclosed. It was disclosed during trial. So is it? We're really just talking about timing of disclosure.
Potentially, yes. Our office asked for the protective order to be modified so that once not only the jury had been seated, but once the opening statements had come in, and it was immediately preceding testimony that was going to play this in live court, that we released this so that there was never a possibility that the juries would hear this before they heard it in open court.
But why counsel, couldn't you have a transfer of venue?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why couldn't you change venue?
The trial judge, Honorable Sage, found that wasn't a reasonable alternative here to closure.
Well, had the call been disclosed and had a number of the members of the Benari responded that they had heard it, and may or may not have been prejudiced by it, why couldn't the court have granted a transfer of venue to Lucas County or to another county where you wouldn't have that juror problem?
Well, I believe the court could have.
That would have been a reasonable alternative.
Well, potentially, Your Honor, but I think that when Criminal Rule 16C was also in play, that comes before, our argument is that comes before solely just looking at the balancing test of whether or not Criminal Rule 6, the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial would trump the First Amendment. Our argument is that Criminal Rule 16C, counsel only, is the first issue that had to be addressed here, because as counsel only, it wouldn't have been disclosed to anyone other than defense counsel.
Was it disclosed to the defense counsel?
It was disclosed to the defense counsel, yes.
Okay, so they knew what was in the prosecutor's arsenal for trial.
Correct.
Okay, so how they fashioned their defense and their progress with the trial and the defense was not affected by the by any of this?
No.
Okay. So, you know, I think Justice O'Donnell brings up a very valid point, that there's mechanisms built into the system to test the independence and the impartiality of a jury, and those weren't even employed initially.
Well,
the judge.
I believe Judge Sage did consider a change of venue. That is part of, when you look at that second part of the test, the second part is whether reasonable alternatives were considered. Judge Sage considered three reasonable alternatives. A transcript of the phone call, a redacted transcript of the phone call, and a change of venue. And the judge found that all three would be unreasonable alternatives.
Based on what? What evidence was put before him that a change of venue would have been unreasonable?
The piece of evidence that was before the trial judge was the tape recording itself. The trial judge heard the tape of the outbound call. He heard the ultimate legal conclusions that Michael Ray made. And not only that, but the judge also heard, and I think it's important because the judge qualifies this as highly inflammatory and emotional, and that really stems from your ability to hear the victim's wife in the background. The victim's wife praying for him to take a breath, asking for God to help, asking for a number of things, and the highly inflammatory nature of that also played into the trial judge's decision and is reflected in his oral decision in this case.
Why is that relevant if we're talking about the defendant's rights? Why is it relevant as to what the victim's wife was saying in the background?
It goes to the prejudicial nature of the tape itself.
Prejudicial to whom?
Prejudicial to the defendant.
Why is that prejudicial to the defendant?
Because it can taint the mind of potential jurors in Butler County. It could taint the mind of anyone who would prejudge his guilt or innocence.
And so again, we're back to knowledge by the potential jurors and the jury pool.
In essence, yes. The balance of keeping something outside of the media and outside of exposure, I think clearly has to go toward the prejudice of ensuring a fair trial, which sure is the potential jurors in the case. I don't think anyone is disagreeing with that point whatsoever. I think, though, that when you look at these kind of tapes, there is an important aspect that right has to be balanced. That right has to be balanced through the test. And I think that's important here is that the trial judge satisfied his duty under the test.
Counsel, let me bring you back to the sequence of calls here. There's first a 911 call, and that is made by the victim's wife, correct?
Correct.
And what information did she relay on that 911 call?
She relayed that there had been an accident and that her husband
accident,
wasn't breathing.
And her husband wasn't breathing. She didn't mention an act of violence. She asked for help, correct?
Correct.
All right. And then the line went dead.
Correct.
Okay. So the dispatcher didn't know if the accident, was it an accident? Was it an act of violence? If I send paramedics only, do I need to send police to protect the paramedics? Am I walking into a, are they walking into a volatile situation? So it really was, it could be classified as the return 911 call or the return call to the residents was to supplement the information for the state here, the dispatcher, to send the appropriate response.
Could it be argued? Yes. Factually, no.
Why not?
She had already sent the appropriate responders. She had already sent the St. Clair Township Fire Department. She had already sent the Butler County Sheriff's Office, as well as her supervisor.
And don't you think that it would have been beneficial for the Sheriff's Department to know that they're walking in, and the Fire Department, the paramedics, et cetera, to know that they're walking into a situation where, number one, there's been violence, number two, this is a homicide, a potential homicide, and there's danger afoot?
Yes, which is exactly why in State v. Hodge and State v. May, Ohio courts, the Second District Court of Appeals, and I believe the Third, have both found that when a hang-up of a 911 call occurs, there implies a duty upon law enforcement to investigate. And so the other aspect of this argument is that this callback wasn't solely to provide aid or CPR, but was a duty to investigate what had occurred at that house.
What was the dispatcher's testimony about why she made that return call?
Her words were that she made it to try to see if anyone needed CPR or anything else. Her questions never involved that. And I think that's an important distinction because the United States Supreme Court in Davis v. Washington, which is part of our argument as well, has said that the subjective intent of a questioner is not what should be looked at, but rather it's the declarant's statements.
But didn't she say, I'm calling to, I can't remember what the phrase was, but I'm calling to see what's going on, or I'm
She said, what happened?
I'm calling to see what happened. Mm-hmm. Isn't that consistent with what she said was her subjective intent? I needed to know more information so I knew what kind of help was needed.
Somewhat, but if you also look at some of her other questions, and I see I'm already out of time, if I may finish. Some of her other answers in the deposition included things such as, well, if a crime's going on, I have a certain set of questions I'm required to have answered.
Is she a law enforcement officer?
She works for the Butler County Sheriff's Department. She is not
so
necessarily...
So she is not a law enforcement officer?
She's not a law enforcement officer, but she is much different than the Hamilton County Call Center employees, which were in the initial Hamilton County case, because she does work for the Sheriff's Department. And she stated during her deposition, the Sheriff's Department has questions she is required to have answered in these type of situations.
Can you have a criminal investigative record for purposes of the Public Records Act without having a law enforcement officer, the one who's doing the investigating?
I would argue, based on this court's precedent, where a teacher now can be held to have testimonial statements and other aspects, that yes, you could.
Okay. I was in the dissent on that case.
That would be our argument, that it wouldn't solely be focused on that. And the reason is, in State v. Davis, they rejected the whole statement approach. And that's the important aspect, is that 911 calls cannot be blanketed per se anymore. Davis v. Washington rejected the whole statement approach and found that statements could be testimonial and non-testimonial within the same call. And that's where justice needs to be done in Ohio, where we need to be able to break those calls up.
And that's your fundamental argument here, that this should not be a per se rule, correct?
Our fundamental argument is that first this qualifies under Criminal Rule 16C, because this is something that was not in place when the Inquirer case was decided. But yes, fundamentally, this per se rule is burdensome and onerous. And the United States Supreme Court in Rock v. Arkansas, Mason v. Braithwaite, has multiple times said per se rules are disfavored in law. And I think, especially with the change in law also of Davis v. Washington, that change in law says there shouldn't be a whole statement approach anymore.
Is this a consistent problem across the state, where 911 calls are the subject of motions such as the one you filed here?
I think increasingly so. And I also think that discovery, especially, is becoming increasingly so. I think that this court has pointed that out. I think Judge Piper, in his concurrence in this case, clearly pointed out that it is becoming a problem. And in fact, he cited the State v. Jerry Adams case, where a CD was given over and someone was executed because they were a snitch. So I think this is a problem, where these protections under Criminal Rule 16C and also D of nondisclosure are put in place so that...
Well, wait a second. They were a little different than confidential or snitch testimony here. I'm talking about 911 calls. Are they a problem for prosecutors across the state and defense counsel with regards to the protection of the defendant's rights?
I would argue that yes, they are. And I would argue not only in this state, but that's the reason we cited the cases out of Arizona, New Jersey, New York, and some of the other states, and especially our case that we cited out of Kentucky, Bowling v. Brandenburg, where the court stated that there are serious concerns over 911 calls about harassment, about victims, and about witnesses.
And if this is a problem, why is this not a problem for the legislature to remedy?
Because the Hamilton County Call Center case was a judicially created per se rule. A judicially created rule can be judicially abrogated.
And it also can be dealt with by the legislature. And the Hamilton County case is how old?
The Hamilton County case was in 1996.
So obviously there have been multiple opportunities for the legislature to take a look at this. and just by statute modify?
There have been, but the legislature isn't the only branch that can take care of this. 14943 does not make 911 calls a per se rule. This court created that rule, and I think importantly, when you go back to that 1996 case, both the Cincinnati Prosecuting Attorney's Office in Hamilton County and the Cincinnati Post argued for a reasonable balancing test.
Mr. Oster, what change do you want? Are you seeking to the 1996 Hamilton County case? What do you want us to do here? What should we write?
Ultimately, I think what the Butler County Prosecutor's Office would like written is that Criminal Rule 16C qualifies as a state law and can be an exception under 149.43A1V.
Our rule is a state law?
Yes.
And
just like in the Beacon Journal case v. Waters, where Criminal Rule 6E was found to be a state law.
And if we say it's a state law, then what's the impact of that in your view?
The impact of that would be that when a prosecutor labels something under Criminal Rule 16C, that designation of counsel only now protects that, be it a statement, be it a 911 call, from dissemination to anyone other than defense counsel.
So prosecutors will then have the right to designate what is or isn't a public record in Ohio in criminal cases, in your view? That's what you think the law should be.
If something is balanced appropriately under Criminal Rule 16C or D, and
not what you said. You said if we label 16C as a state law, then a prosecutor can designate a document as a public record or not for dissemination to anyone other than opposing counsel. And that's what you want the law to be.
That's what I believe that's what the law already is, or should be, yes. Because under the Waters case, it doesn't clearly make I don't understand how Criminal Rule 6E could be a state law. But
and you think that comports with the public records law?
Yes, I do. And I think there is a balance built into Criminal Rule 16 as well. Criminal Rule 16F allows a balance.
We don't agree with you. The current law is that 911 calls are public records, correct?
Correct. And if
this gives discretion to a prosecutor to declare a public record not subject to dissemination.
Correct.
Okay.
But there would also be a secondary fallback, which is still whether the Sixth Amendment right to fair trial would trump the First Amendment, which this court has previously held in the Vindicator case to as well be an exception under 14943A1B.
Well, that's a different issue with respect to what the Constitution is, but you're asking, if I'm understanding your argument correctly, for prosecutors to have discretion to disclose or not disclose what are otherwise public records.
Yes, that is one of our arguments.
All right,
it is
I
not
understand
the
your argument.
Argument.
Yes. Thank you.
And we believe that, just like Judge Piper said, that prosecutors have these ethical rules and the ability, and that we are bound to protect the Sixth Amendment right of a defendant. And that's what Prosecutor Moser did here. If we're bound by those rules, we're asking for the tools to be able to enforce those and not be caught in a catch-22 where ethically we have to protect that. There's a rule that allows us to do it, but somehow we're barred from that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Greiner.
Good morning, Your Honor. John Greiner on behalf of the Cincinnati Inquirer. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal because this is a cross appeal situation. I think it is important to get away from this idea that the designation of this call as a 911 call is the critical inquiry. It is really not. Call it what you want. It is the call itself was the initiating event that ultimately led to a criminal investigation. So this idea of a per se rule that is somehow judicially created, I think, is simply not accurate. What this court has done is simply interpreted 14943 consistently through the years, and the confidential law enforcement investigatory record exception, and simply looked at the statute. There are certain attributes that are required in order to establish the clear exception. One is it an investigation? And this court has consistently held that when there is simply the initiating document is not the investigatory record. 911 calls and incident reports for example, are initiating events. So we've seen it not only in the Cincinnati Enquirer case with 911 calls, but we've seen it in the State X Rel Beacon Journal versus Maurer case, where a 37-page incident report that included witness statements and narratives from investigating police officers is not an investigatory record. It is an incident report.
Counsel, you said it's not a per se rule, but I'm looking at Hamilton County, and it says, accordingly, we reject the case-by-case approach advocated by Hamilton County and the Post and adopt the per se rule as asserted by the Enquirer.
It used that language, but, Your Honor, my point is that this is not a situation where this court said, you know, we think that there's some sort of magic about a 911 call that makes it exempt from the Public Records Act. The fact of the matter is the analysis should go like this, and it has gone like this. Is it in the first instance a public record? Of course it is. It's a document it's a record that documents the activities of a public office. Now the next question is, does it fall into an exemption? The answer is no. The closest exemption that it would fall into would be the confidential law enforcement investigatory record, and it doesn't fall into that exemption for a number of reasons, one of which is that a 911 call is not an investigation. It triggers an investigation. That is the point. The other thing is, and sometimes, you know, we miss the obvious because we get involved in collateral stuff. And even if this were an investigatory call, it's not, but even if it were, it still wouldn't qualify for the clear exemption. It's a two-step process that—
To distinguish between the 911 call and the 911 callback?
I don't think there is any meaningful distinction. The Court of Appeals correctly found that that was a continuation. The questions that the dispatcher—
Well, they said it was a continuation. I guess, generously, Mr. Oster would say, it's not a call to 911, it's a call from 911 to another call, to another number.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't mean to interrupt. The 911 dispatcher, by law, by state law, has a duty as a 911 operator to determine the appropriate emergency provider. It's revised code 5507.01a. That is a right. Duty of a 911 caller. That is exactly what she was doing at that time. And again, I'll leave it to you to look at what she asked about. What she asked about primarily in that callback was, is he breathing? Get close to him, hear if he's breathing. She testified that one of the reasons she called back was she may have to help direct CPR. Her intent, her purpose for calling back was to get additional information and see if she could offer assistance to the victim of this accident, not crime victim, because she had no reason to suspect a crime had even occurred.
Well, that leads me to my next question then. You say, first of all, the analysis should be whether or not it's a public record. Then secondly, whether or not there's an exception that would take it out of that status. Okay. What about the argument as advanced by Judge Sage in this instance? There is a constitutional right to a fair trial for a defendant who has made an admission during this callback.
Absolutely, and there certainly is a couple of things. One, the Sixth Amendment doesn't trump the First Amendment, nor does the First Amendment trump the Sixth Amendment.
How do we resolve the discourse then between the First and the Sixth Amendment? Is that a judgment that this court is called on here because of the admission against interest when Ray says, I snapped, I did this?
There's a couple of things. There has got to be the mere fact that the tape contains potentially prejudicial information. I mean, most of the evidence, all of the evidence that the state's going to introduce, including this tape, by the way, Prosecutor Moser at the get-go, at the hearing on the protective order, told the court it was his intention to introduce this tape into evidence. So any evidence the prosecution offers is going to be prejudicial to the defendant. That's why they offer it, number one. The question is, however, will the prejudicial effect overwhelm the fair trial interest of the defendant. And for that, you need evidence. You cannot simply presume. In fact, this court has
said— Well, that's really not the question, though, because we're looking at the First Amendment right of your client to disseminate information or to have it at a time when it could prejudicially affect the right of the defendant to a fair trial.
This court has said in State ex rel Toledo Blade versus Henry County, in the absence of properly introduced evidence, there is no reason for a trial court to conclude that there will be prejudicial publicity and to presume that such publicity will create a threat to the administration of justice. In the absence of properly introduced evidence, there was no evidence whatsoever in this case as to the prejudicial effect or the effect of publicity or the prospect of publicity, nor did Judge Sage consider in any meaningful fashion.
Counsel, let me stop you there for a second. When a trial court has what is obviously a confession on a 911 call, are you saying he needs additional evidence that would be prejudicial to a defendant?
He needs evidence that it would be so prejudicial that the fair trial right of the defendant could not be protected, A, and he also needs to consider thoughtfully and meaningfully alternatives. And Judge Sage did not do that.
Counsel,
in this case.
Counsel, what's the compelling need of the inquirer to publish this prior to the trial? What's the need? I mean, I'm looking at this, and it seems to me, perhaps for starters, we ought to pull back from Hamilton County on a per se rule and look at some sort of balancing test, and it seems to me that's what the judge did here. He looked at what was in play and made a call. So what's the compelling need to rush out with the information that's on this tape to the public prior to the trial?
Your Honor, there's no evidence that the Enquirer would have published the tape. It never got the tape. The Enquirer has the right, certainly, to use editorial judgment and make a decision. There is no evidence at all in this record that the Enquirer or any other media
so
was intending to go and publish.
We're,
but
we're
to
the trust
media
to,
and the public,
we're,
I think.
We're to trust to your editors rather than to the judge to make the decision as to what might or might not be prejudicial to the defendant?
I've always liked Thomas Jefferson's quote that if he had to choose between a government with no newspapers and newspapers with no government, he would take the latter rather than the former.
Mr. Greiner, could we talk? The Hamilton County case was decided in 1996, and the Crawford line of cases, Davis and so on, the right of the defendant now to confrontation has been strengthened. And does this not impact this case? No one's talked about Crawford and that whole principle that has now been established by the Supreme Court. How does that affect what we're talking about today?
Your Honor, I'd still believe that a court, and I don't think the State Ex Rel Enquirer versus Heath case, which this court decided, has been affected at all by those decisions. The point is that a court must consider evidence. It cannot. We do not trust it to the gut feel of the trial judge in this setting. There simply has to be. And this court has said that you simply have got, in the absence of properly introduced evidence, that is not, we don't trust the judge's gut feel to make that determination. There is not a presumption that pretrial publicity, even pervasive pretrial publicity, will deprive the defendant of his fair trial right.
But
it's
if there
concern.
Was no one live to testify, to confront the defendant, it's possible that the 911 tape would not even be presented, correct? If it was considered a violation of the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, that would never be in a trial. And if we have a situation where the press has divulged the content, does that not impact the fairness of the trial?
It could. And the question at that point would be to conduct a voir dire to find jurors who were not aware of that. And I think it's possible in a county the size of Butler County to find 12 jurors who could honestly say that they were not aware of that disclosure. And if you can't, then you change the venue. But these are all alternatives that need to be considered that simply were not considered.
Counsel, let me bring you back to Justice Pfeiffer's line of questioning here. And his question was, you know, what's the overriding need, you know, the compelling interest for you to receive this record? Now, my understanding is that you don't have to prove a need. No one who requests a public record needs to justify that request. If it's, you know, a township record of you know, whatever, or a state record, or, you know, there's exceptions to the public record, but you don't have to give your name. You don't have to give a reason. You can walk in and ask the record keeper to give you a copy, and it has to be done within a reasonable time and a complete assessment, correct?
Your Honor, that's absolutely correct, and I was going to make that point. In fact, it is a violation of the Public Records Act for the custodian of the records to even ask for that information unless there is a reason that will permit the clerk to more efficiently produce the record.
But having said that, there is the tension between the First Amendment and the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial, and you would recognize that.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor.
And that is appropriate for courts on occasion to find a limitation on the release of public record, not maybe forever, but in circumstances such as this, to safeguard. Your problem is that Judge Sage, as you said, you know, had a gut feeling, maybe shot from the hip, however you want to, you know, classify this, without actual evidence. And how would he have received that evidence? That's the question I want to ask you. Prior to voir dire, I believe at voir dire, the panel could have been questioned, and their knowledge and their ability to sit impartially could have been ascertained. But prior to something like that, how could that happen?
I think you could have talked, you could have presented expert testimony in the form of former prosecutor, a judge, a expert in communications and media that could talk about the effect. There is the possibility.
Is that the release of this kind of information that universal, where you could have an expert come in and testify to the court about the impact of a 911 call that, in essence, is a confession?
I believe, yes, Your Honor. I believe there is sufficient data that could be presented. There has to be some effort made to at least hear that evidence.
That's where you find the shortcoming here. The you know, if you're going to zero in on one thing that was done here that should sustain your position, is the judge's failure to have a hearing.
Well, certainly on that issue, I think it should have never been brought in front of the judge. We haven't gotten to the whole idea that this was essentially an effort to get a declaratory judgment as an end run around the Public Records Act, which we had raised in our writ of prohibition, because we just haven't had a chance to talk about it yet. But okay. It should never have been in front of the court.
Have been unreasonable for the judge to delay dissemination of the 911 call until after voir dire and a jury was seated?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because again, this call does not fall under the exception because it doesn't identify any of the four factors in the second step of the clear result, or the clear exception analysis. Plus, again, the judge should have heard, he was required to hear evidence and consider the alternatives, which he didn't do. He could have delayed.
If the court were concerned about seating a jury, could he have delayed release of the 911 request until after the jury was seated?
I think he would have had to at least consider some form of evidence about whether or not other alternatives could have worked. And frankly, the barring of release of publicly available information is such an extraordinary call, frankly, that there is no, you know, the change of venue. You get there first. In other words, on sort of the chain of priorities, you talk voir dire.
And who bears the cost of that change?
I suppose the county would bear the cost of that.
Not the one requesting the information and disseminating it.
No.
Counsel, would you agree that this problem could be remedied legislatively?
If there were a problem, if and the legislature decided there was a problem,
well,
I've not seen any evidence that
counsel,
this is a problem.
Counsel, wait till I ask you a question. I'm talking about the Hamilton case. There could be a legislative fix, if you believe that a fix is necessary, that would exempt 911 calls from a public record status. You would agree with that?
I'm sorry. Anyway, the legislature could certainly do that.
Pardon me?
The legislature could certainly do that.
Thank you.
The one thing that opposing counsel had said was that this could potentially fit under V, that a criminal rule, could be considered state law. Do you have any comment on that?
I think that is precluded by this court's decision in Steckman, that incident reports have to be released on demand, and that the public record status cannot be defrocked by a decision of the prosecutor. I think there are any number of policy problems presented by the theory that a prosecutor can, in his own discretion, take material out of the Public Records Act. So, no, I don't.
Do you have anything, though, that talks about the idea that a rule, a criminal rule or rule of evidence, is a state law? It's a broader question.
I believe that I would have to concede that the decision on 6E indicates that a criminal rule could be deemed a state law.
That's what case, please?
I can't recall the case name, but it was the finding that criminal rule 6E that deals with grand jury confidentiality constitutes a state law.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Oster, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
May it please the court, unfortunately with only 30 seconds, the case is Beacon Journal v. Waters. Let me address the fines and the attorney's fees here for a second while bringing in the rest of this. In this case, the prosecutor is faced with an outbound call. It is not a exact 911. There's never been in law this continuation theory, especially a unilateral continuation. It's just Deborah Ridenour that continues. Michael Ray was not part of the first. Criminal Rule 16C, 2010, before the Inquirer case. Davis v. Washington, which is the Crawford line of questioning, is new. The Sixth Amendment right is here. So you have a prosecutor who honors their ethical duties, honors the criminal rules as written now, brings this to a judge to protect a Sixth Amendment, brings the correct two-part test to balance it, and in fact, the First District in the Dinkelocker case said these type of questions should be decided by a trial judge, not by the custodian of records.
But trial judge with evidence before him or her.
The 911 tape is evidence.
But there was no bolstering evidence as to the effect. That's what he's not talking about the 911 tape. It's the effect of the release of 911 tape prior to trial and the tainting of a jury. That's a continuous process to be analyzed, and there's no evidence that Judge Sage received any information as to that.
I think the 911 tape is enough evidence.
So it speaks for itself. It is per se an example of a prejudicial, it's all prejudicial, of course, but so prejudicial that it outweighs the defendant's ability to have a fair trial.
I think in this case, that's exactly what Judge Sage found. And he found that based upon the tape, which includes the ultimate legal conclusion and Ms. Ray. He found that based upon the argument of counsel, who no case has ever said there has to be expert testimony in these situations. And what Judge Sage has here is he's got experienced trial attorneys for both the defense, the prosecution, and the Inquirer, and the Hamilton Journal.
Counsel, isn't it a fact that the Court of Appeals found that Judge Sage acted in good faith, that the prosecutor acted in good faith, but they violated the public records law? Hence, attorney fees were awarded. Isn't that what happened?
Yes and no. The Court of Appeals definitely found that Judge Sage and Prosecutor Moser acted in good faith, and acted in good faith in trying to protect a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to fair trial. But they found that their reasonable actions, acting in good faith, did not lead to the award of attorney's fees because they acted in good faith, because this was a situation in which it wasn't a pure outbound call and they didn't, it wasn't a pure 911. So they found that that good faith did not lead to attorney's fees. The interesting part there is, while finding this good faith and while finding that the prosecutor acted within his ethical rules, the same test which is used to say that the good faith and the reasonableness shouldn't lead to attorney's fees is the same test that should have found it also shouldn't lead to statutory damages.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, You may start with 30 seconds.
Your Honor, good faith is not the standard. It's just not. The subjective good faith is not. And the court correctly awarded statutory damages here, but incorrectly denied the attorney fee request on the basis of the prosecutor's quote unquote good faith, the subjective good faith. The Public Records Act lays out precisely the standard that is to be followed, and that is whether a well-informed public official would reasonably believe that he was acting correctly and that his conduct furthered the policy underlying the authority asserted. And that simply is not the case here. Because the 12th District applied a subjective good faith standard on the attorney fee question incorrectly. That is not the standard. Your Honor, the idea that—
Are you saying Judge Sage then didn't have a reasonable belief he was acting properly in balancing the Sixth Amendment right of the defendant to a fair trial against the release of the information?
He didn't execute it properly.
Pardon me?
He didn't execute it properly because he did not consider evidence on the question, nor did he consider reasonable alternatives to the non-release.
When you say he didn't consider evidence, didn't he consider the confession that Ray made on the tape?
And that gets me back to the other point that Mr. Oster made in rebuttal, this notion that the tape can stand alone. Your Honor, it cannot. This court in State ex rel Toledo Blade said that pretrial publicity, even pervasive adverse publicity, does not inevitably lead to an unfair trial. That is precisely the standard. The opposite is what Mr. Oster would have you apply here, and it's completely contrary to your precedent.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Thank you.